Welcome to Living with Lyme, the podcast where we educate, advocate, and collaborate about Lyme disease, hear from experts as they share reliable information about how to live with Lyme disease. And now here's your host, nurse practitioner, Cindy Kennedy.
Hi, everybody. This is your host, Cindy Kennedy. You're listening to another episode of Living with Lyme. And I am so excited to have Dr. Ken Liegner with me. And he is a well-versed Lyme literate physician. He is well-known in the Lyme treatment community. And he is what we call out here the Lyme literate doc. And you'll see that a lot of other doctors that are not as well-versed, we don't really call them the LLMDs. Dr. Liegner is board certified as a medical internist, and he practices caring for people with acute and chronic Lyme disease as well as co-infections. He's in Pawlings, New York. He has authored countless research works, and he has also authored the book In the Crucible of Chronic Lyme Disease. And I'm very excited to welcome you. Hi, Dr. Liegner.
Thank you so much, Cindy.
I'm so happy to have you as a guest here. You are one of the top researchers, top authors, top treaters of Lyme disease. And I know there's a little bit of a story back there, and I've read it, but tell me, how did you get started treating Lyme disease?
Pure chance.
Oh, the perfect storm.
I just stumbled into it.
You did. Did you get roots? Did you form your roots in the New York area, or were you always there?
Well, I went to medical school at New York Medical College in Valhalla, New York, in Westchester County. And then I went, you know, I did some training there, and then I went elsewhere. And then I was in Washington, D.C. for a year doing surgical critical care at Washington Hospital Center's MedStar unit. And it was great training, and it's the kind of training I wanted to have, very broad training. But then I really decided that's not what I wanted to do, you know, for a career. It's quite grueling type of work. So I decided to come back to Westchester County to start a private medical practice. That was around 1985 or so. And we decided to purchase a home, and I chose a home that was, I thought, suitable to turning the lower floor into a medical office. It was a raised ranch, and took out a business loan with Chemical Bank for $80,000, which was a very scary thing to do.
That's great now, if you could get something for $80,000 in that area.
No, that was just for the renovations.
Oh, I see.
That was the renovations to turn basically a semi-finished basement into a medical office. So I hired a contractor to build it out, and hung up my shingle and waited, waited for the world to discover me.
And then what? People were just coming in with crazy symptoms, and what happened?
Well, initially I just kind of did general medicine, you know, and did a little bit of critical care at my hospital. Back in those days, like, I was the only critical care physician because nobody else, it was a new training. It was a new field, critical care. So I did some of that and did some, you know, general medicine and saw, you know, a wide variety of patients. And, you know, my house was a home office in a little sort of a cul-de-sac area. So, you know, some of the people would be, you know, neighbors up the street would come in, you know, and did general medicine. Then, you know, I started seeing patients with this new entity, Lyme disease, which I knew virtually nothing about it. I just knew the name. That's all I knew. And they were interesting cases and, you know, challenging, you know, puzzling, new disease. And, you know, I started seeing more patients, and then I realized they were strange. They were odd. They didn't seem to behave the way they were supposed to behave. And so that was intriguing. And then around 90, so that was around 85, I started seeing patients just because at that time there really was a burgeoning epidemic in Westchester. And so that's what I meant. I just kind of plunked myself down to this burgeoning epidemic unbeknownst to me, what I was getting myself in for. And then around 1988, there was a local library, which was on a sort of a, like a expansion plan. They, it was a little tiny library in Armonk, and they were doing a building expansion thing. And they asked me if I wanted to do a talk. And in fact, I arranged like a medical series for them. And, I decided to talk on, guess what? Lyme disease, because I was seeing these patients. I didn't know all that much about it at the time. And I took advantage of the medical library at Northern Westchester Hospital Center in Mount Kisco. And over a couple of 3 months, I reviewed a lot of the then available world literature, which in 1988 wasn't that much. So in 3 months, you could really, you know, review a lot of it. And I gave a talk in the basement of this library. And there was a lot of interest in Lyme because a lot of people were getting sick. People didn't know a lot about it. So I gave this talk. Turned out that the basement of this library was like chock full. It was like 300 people crammed into this, you know, basement of the library.
Wow.
And so I gave my talk. All of a sudden, I'm an instant expert.
Wow. There you go.
Okay. But I knew I wasn't an expert. It's just because I'd reviewed the literature, I knew more than anybody else around at the time. And so that's when my practice started kind of exploding with patients with tick-borne illness.
Right.
And it kind of grew from there.
What kind of testing was available back then?
Well, this was back in the day when there was not very much testing available. In fact, I was just going over some records with one of my staff from back then. We didn't even have Western blots.
So what were we looking at?
All we had back then was the ELISA, the enzyme-linked immunosorbent assay. There was not even, I mean, Western blot at that time was really a big deal research thing. You know, you couldn't really get them that easily.
Right.
And then, of course, then they became to be more widely used, and it was fairly standard to get both an ELISA and a Western blot.
Right.
But back in the day, you know, all you had was the ELISA and the clinical.
Right. Well, that's so important because we all know that Lyme disease and, you know, you want to shake the medical community because you got people here that are not testing positive and truly they need to be treated on a clinical basis. And then we end up with people being misdiagnosed and these healthcare providers just not really getting it. And so now we've got a whole host of people that are still sick and this time is going on and going on and going on. And now we're into what we call chronic Lyme disease. So give us an idea of what that is. How do you classify it? And is there a diagnosis?
Is there a diagnosis?
That's not what I meant. Is there criteria to be set?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, it's very interesting to say that there is no such thing as Lyme on a chronic basis. You know, whether it's treated or not treated is absurd to even question that. It's as though you would say, is there such a thing as late stage syphilis?
Right.
You know, nobody questions that.
Right.
But for a wide variety of reasons, a lot of them political and socioeconomic in nature, the idea that there might be such a thing as Lyme on a chronic basis, even following treatment, there has been, I would say, a manufactured controversy about this, something that is so obvious, it's ridiculous. I mean, the idea that there's even any controversy about that itself should invite scrutiny about just why that is.
Right. And, you know, that could be a whole nother episode. But I can only imagine if we were back in the Western days and we had one group of people that were firm believers and one group of people on the other end of the saloon that wasn't believers, that we could have a big shootout over this. This could raise a lot of tempers, and I've seen it happen. I, as my listeners know, I'm a nurse practitioner, and I do have physicians as patients. And I will say that if I've brought up the idea about Lyme disease, and I get some ridiculous statements, you know, the fact that, oh, a tick has to be on for more than, you know, 36 hours, and it takes that long for them to regurgitate. And I just like shake my head. I'm like, you can't do that. There's so many, there's such a small percentage of people that even get a bullseye. And so, you know, we're doing a very bad job of early diagnoses of this kind of condition. One of my biggest questions here is there a time frame where you feel that, you know, if people have had symptoms more than 6 months, they're more chronic? Or is it, geez, let's treat them and see if their body responds, their immune system picks up, and now they will not be chronic? How do you feel about that?
Well, there's an in process. There's an attempt to, you know, define exactly what chronic Lyme disease is in a formal definition. A lot of people use a cutoff of 6 months of symptoms or 6 months untreated as a cutoff, not just for Lyme but for other conditions that get the name chronic. You know,
right.
So a lot of people, somewhat arbitrarily, you know, use that as a cutoff. When I use the term chronic Lyme, what I mean is that the illness is due literally to the Lyme disease organism or closely related organisms that fall within that you know, species or related species, and that the illness is actually due to that in particular. Some people try to lump that a lot, you know, with other tick-borne co-infections, and those are bona fide and real, and they certainly can make the picture much more complicated. But what I mean when I talk about chronic Lyme is the illness that is due to ongoing infection.
Okay.
Not post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome that implies that it's a post-infectious, non-infectious entity.
And okay.
As you know, people have proposed that as a alternative to chronic Lyme, which again, I think for political reasons has gotten a lot of opprobrium attached to using that term, and I think that's completely political smear tactics.
Okay, I'm. What is an opprobrium? I don't have a dictionary.
You know, opprobrium, hateful ridicule.
Oh, okay.
That is directed at the idea of chronic Lyme because
it's
a ridiculous idea. Of course, no such thing exists, right?
Well, that's here's the problem. You know what? I don't care what you call it. Let the people on the other end of the saloon give it a name. But why do people suffer, and what can we do about it?
Well, basically, scientific research and education is what is needed.
Right. But what do you do? What do you do for the person that's sick and has been sick and has been treated and for a prolonged period of time?
Well, one has to do one's best to try to figure out what in the world is wrong with them.
Okay.
And maybe it's Lyme, maybe it's something else, maybe it's co-infections, you know, and there does exist a lot of possibility for errors in diagnosis in both directions, meaning people who have other conditions could be misdiagnosed with Lyme on the one hand, and then people with Lyme disease, because of its very wide range of manifestations, can be misdiagnosed with some other non-infectious conditions and get all kinds of treatment. Some of that treatment can be very toxic and dangerous for a condition that actually often would respond to fairly simple, relatively inexpensive antimicrobial therapy.
Okay, so I know that I've learned the problem rests with the individual's immune system. What's going on with the immune system?
Well, the immune system is crucial, you know, critical, and it's often been said that if one has any kind of an infection, even if it's just a strep infection, although antibiotics are helpful, ultimately it's the role of the immune system to eradicate the infection, eradicate it or contain it if it can. If you don't have a functioning immune system, i.e., you know, HIV/AIDS, for example, or other immune deficiency states, antibiotics can become relatively ineffective or completely ineffective.
So,
the immune system is extremely important.
I understand that, you know, a prolonged infection, and we know that the spirochete of Lyme disease can take on different shapes. It can hide, it can burrow into tissue, it can burrow into organs, and it does do a number on your immune system. Am I correct?
I think you are correct. A lot of people have had that concern, and there's actually a good deal of scientific study that demonstrates that. Most notably, that sticks out in my mind is the work of Nicole Baumgarth. I think she's from out in the West Coast, maybe Irvine, University of California. I think she's from Irvine, demonstrating in a mouse model that the Lyme organism completely disrupts the germinal centers of the lymph nodes and other, organs of the reticuloendothelial system. So in order for things to progress and be recognized by the immune system, you need an intact immune system. And there's an architecture to the lymph nodes that includes something called germinal centers. If you take a lymph node and cut it in half and look at it under the microscope and using certain stains, you'll see that there, within the lymph node, there are sort of little spherical areas that have an architecture to them, and those are necessary to develop, you know, the IgM response, and then over time there's what's called class switching from IgM to IgG, and a lot of different immune cells are involved in that. And in a mouse model, of course, the mouse is not a man, but in a mouse model, Nicole has demonstrated that architecture gets completely disrupted. And often you will see persistence of the IgM response and a failure to class switch to IgG. And of course, a lot of us dealing with the patients with that disease that doesn't exist, chronic Lyme disease, see that very, very commonly.
We'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsors. Botanical medicines are an important part of an integrative Lyme disease program. Biocidin from Biobotanical Research is a professional strength, broad-based formula that has been extensively researched for effectiveness as nutritional support in Lyme and co-infections. Ask your practitioner about Biocidin LSF and visit biocidin.com for more information. Allotests. Did you know that what you eat affects the way you feel? One simple test can tell you which foods to eat and which ones to avoid. Many people underestimate the power of simple changes. Allotest Medical Laboratory has provided food allergy and sensitivity testing services for over 38 years. Change your diet, change your life. The first step, Allotest. Visit www.foodallergy.com. Master Supplements specializes in probiotics, enzymes, and fiber that all support digestive and immune health. Their products provide results that you can feel working with a 60-day money-back guarantee. Their staff is available to help you decide which products and programs are right for you. Visit master-supplements.com or call 800-926-2961 for more info.
I'd like to explain to the listeners the difference between IgM and IgG. And the IgM, I'll take something more simple like chickenpox. Someone gets infected with chickenpox, they're going to produce the initial antibodies, which are called IgM, and we always say modern, so we remember the M. And then after a period of time, after you've had the illness and you create more long-term antibodies, you basically lose that IgM and you have what we hope is a persistent IgG, and that shows that you have had exposure to it. Even in somebody's case that they haven't gotten very sick with, say, chickenpox, that's where we know that the exposure has occurred and you've built antibodies against it, just in case people don't know what the IgM and IgG is. So
that's correct.
Do you use the CD57 test?
Personally, I don't.
You don't.
I know some of my colleagues do use that.
Yeah, that seemed to be the biggest way I was diagnosed, and some Igenix labs that kind of came back consistently not positive and not negative, kind of indeterminate. But that's, you know, ever since there's been a lot of exposure to this podcast, there's been other podcasts done for Resilience Radio where they've asked me to be a guest. I've had some exposure via news and also our local paper did a wonderful article. I've gotten a lot of emails and notifications through Facebook, and people feel like my journey is very similar to theirs. So let's just walk through me as a case study. So I come to you. I have had a variety of symptoms for a persistent period of time. I've been sent to you because I've had to, you know, take care of myself practically. You know, I've seen rheumatologists, I've seen PCPs. I had a sleep study because I was having such trouble sleeping. The fatigue level was horrible. At this point, my hands are so swollen, and x-rays show some fluid in the capsules, in my knuckles, in my wrists. But everybody's, you know, I don't know. Nobody knows what the heck's wrong with me. So I come and I see you and we do some tests, and clinically, you know, that's the angle we have to take. So we get treated, antibiotics, oral triple antibiotics, neurologic symptoms are occurring, personality issues, forgetfulness, and at that point, you know, I had a PICC line. So put a PICC line in, antibiotics IV for a period of time, then a really bad allergic reaction. And we just kind of said, that's enough of that. Did in the process, because of clinical symptoms, get treated for Babesia. And so after that, when I was done with antibiotics and I really needed to try an alternative route, doing some homeopathy, doing some supplements, etc., periods of time, up and down, just still don't feel well. And so this is what a lot of people have, and they don't know where to go. What would your suggestion be?
Well, as a physician, want to just underscore the importance of a very careful history, taking a very careful history in terms of what kinds of symptoms, you know, the person has had going back to the onset of their illness. You know, what when was the last time they felt rather well and what changed? It's very important to ascertain some basic things like, have they had any definite known tick attachments or eruptions that might have been consistent with erythema migrans, the rash of Lyme, and or have they had significant opportunities for exposure to ticks and the disease that they carry in areas that are known to be endemic, you know, for Lyme and tick-borne diseases? And of course, if you query almost any human and ask and speak to them in enough depth, it will turn out that they've had some exposure, because I mean ticks are fairly ubiquitous. People, you know, live in different places, they vacation, and so I mean, if you it's hard to think of a person who might not have had any risk.
Well, the other thing that most people have dogs, and the dogs are fairly well protected with all of their, you know, Seresto collars or sprays or, you know, their Frontline or Advantic stuff, and they bring them into the home.
Exactly. Indoor, outdoor pets can be the so-called Trojan horse, no matter how careful you are. And even though you may treat these animals, a lot of the treatments that we have, what they do is they kill the ticks on the animal when the tick feeds, but does not necessarily kill the tick when it's on the coat of the animal, you know? So in other words, theoretically, an indoor outdoor pet could bring ticks into the home that can go off the animal, onto the carpet, onto the bedding. And, you know, I think animals are wonderful, but especially if they're indoor outdoor, they can pose some risk. And also ticks, if you didn't know it, they will actively seek out their hosts, and they can detect carbon dioxide and will follow carbon dioxide gradients to find a host. So, yeah, I mean, and it's also important to emphasize many people who really and truly have Lyme, you know, bulletproof cases of Lyme, do never give a history of known tick attachment or of a recognized rash. And of course, that's often people show up, you know, years later, quite ill with fully diagnostic tests if they're lucky.
Right. And
they went for years because nobody really thought about Lyme, because
right.
you know, they didn't come in saying I had a tick bite and a rash.
Right. For people who don't know, when we talk about carbon dioxide, that's actually what is in our breath as we breathe out. So that's
correct.
Why, yeah. So they're just looking for breathing people. So everybody has to breathe.
Or critters, doesn't have to be people.
True. A lot of people are depressed. They don't feel well. They're not finding the help they need, or, you know, they have been treated and for a significant period of time. Is there hope that these chronic Lyme sufferers are going to get better? And what would you say they need to do?
Well, first of all, I believe there's hope. I believe that we could and can have better methods of both diagnosis and treatment, not only for Lyme disease, but the other so-called tick-borne co-infections. And that is beginning to happen. So it's a time that things are, you know, looking more encouraging than they have for a long time. We know there are at least three or four academic groups who are actively working to determine if we can develop improved methods of treatment for Lyme. You know, there's the Kim Lewis's group at Northeastern University.
Okay.
Ying Zhang's group at Johns Hopkins. There's a gentleman named Jay Rajadas, who's at Stanford, and also Eva Shapi. They are all looking to new approaches to try to develop improved methods of treatment. And also at the same time, we're on the cusp of improved methods of diagnosis as well.
Oh, I'm so excited.
That's been a big part of the problem, obviously. You know, a big part of the problem is the misuse of the two-tier system of testing that was developed by the CDC, supposedly intended strictly for epidemiologic purposes, but widely misused by the insurers to deny people both diagnosis and reimbursement for care.
Oh, it's awful. It's awful. Back before in Massachusetts, but back before they passed a bill that said that insurance companies mandated by the state of Massachusetts could no longer deny antibiotic coverage, my insurance company was rah-rah, sis boomba, up until day 28. And then day 29, there was no antibiotics at my door. And we got a letter saying that at that point, everything else was experimental. And I'm like, are you kidding me? So then now the venture goes out and I'm, you know, got to find out how can I pay for this? And as you know, it's people can lose, they lose their income because they can't work. They lose savings. They lose family, marriages, you know, that whole thing. And it's it's unfortunate, and I can only hope with the amount of infections and cases and people really opening their eyes to this that we can get some big changes, because it's truly unfortunate. And I know that there are people that are really suffering out there, and the quality of their life is very poor.
Well, what has happened is that the situation has gotten so bad because of severely misguided policies that wide swaths of the population are affected, including, guess what, you know, legislators, their children, their wives, their staffers, themselves. And you get enough of that, and all of a sudden, things begin to change. You know, it becomes feasible for there to be legislation, you know, that affects policy. The amount of resources that has been allocated to Lyme and tick-borne disease is, over the past 30 years, is pitiful.
It is.
And a lot of it has gone to certain individuals who continue to promote the notion that there's no such thing as chronic Lyme disease. There's no such thing as so-called seronegative Lyme disease, meaning Lyme disease existing when the standard tests are negative.
Right.
And that's a big, big issue. So-called direct detection methods, some of which have been developed, some of which have been promising and then mothballed, which would enable the doctors and the patients to know with confidence who really has Lyme disease and who doesn't. And also, not only do they have it, but what is the status of the infection?
Right.
A lot of those methods have been suppressed for political and socioeconomic reasons.
What do you think is the best Lyme test? Or, as I have read and learned, that really you kind of got to use a variety of testing methods.
Yeah, well, clinical is extremely important, and clinical suspicion is important. Nonetheless, you still want to, if you can, you know, use the methods that are available to try to figure out what is going on. There's no, quote, best Lyme test right now.
There isn't.
Okay. Many of us need to use a range of methods, including, you know, the screening test, the ELISA, so-called, and the Western blot. We usually send out to at least two different good laboratories, because we have found you cannot rely on a single laboratory, even a good laboratory. You also use, you know, whatever direct detection methods are available. Right now in New York State, we are able to use polymerase chain reaction as a method. There are other methods that have been developed and are beginning to be utilized. For example, Ceres Nanoscience has their Lyme nanotrap test, which is an antigen detection test in urine, that's not yet available in New York State, but it is becoming available in other states. And again, there are other cutting-edge research tools that are beginning, you know, that are on the horizon, but they're not quite ready for prime time.
Right. So we just got to hold on a little while longer. And so, you know, before we wrap up here, your information is wonderful. And I do know that you and your nurse practitioner are taking on new patients. And I did travel to Mount Kisco for treatment, and I can tell you it's doable from Western Massachusetts. And so I encourage people who are listening to this podcast and have suspicion and you're not getting the appropriate answers or the appropriate treatment to possibly go visit Dr. Liegner or his nurse practitioner. But I have a couple of funny questions for you, and I didn't tell you about that. Sometimes I do, but I've forgotten, so I apologize. You said you wanted things to stump you, so here we go. Ready?
I said I was expecting some curveballs.
Okay, here's one.
Okay.
What ticks you off?
What ticks me off? Oh, well, the injustice that persons with Lyme disease have suffered over the past 30 years also ticks me off, that the physicians who treated the patients have also suffered quite a bit of injustice as well. But looks to me like there might be some comeuppance.
Okay. All right. Well, see, you didn't flinch.
No, you're aware of the litigation that recently was undertaken, right?
Tell me.
You're not aware of it.
I might be, but tell me and tell my listeners.
Well, there's a woman named Lisa Torrey. She and another patient, I'm not sure of the pronunciation of his name, something like David Karusek or something like that, over the past 10 years or so, apparently, decided to take it upon themselves to really build a case for collusion by certain players in along with the insurance industry to essentially defraud the American public. Mm-hmm. And they did all the groundwork, and they presented it to several groups of attorneys who have deep experience in this area. And what I was told was that before the attorneys agreed to take the case, the groundwork that Lisa and her other coworker did was presented to academic legal experts at Harvard to ask them whether there really was a case.
Hmm.
And the answer was in the affirmative.
Yes.
So that was recently filed, and I'm sure it's available. I looked at it's a civil action. It's a 53-page brief, and it's available for people to review on the internet. And I did go through it, all 53 pages of it, and I think they build a very compelling case.
I did read something about something that was going on in Texas, and that was against...
Yes, it's...
Is this similar or the same?
It's the same.
It is.
Yes.
Okay. So it is that. I did read about that. I didn't get the names. So, gosh, there's some good changes. And I'm happy to see that. It's just so difficult for both patients and certainly the caregivers like yourselves and many others that are just so frustrated and put on the spot and kind of blackballed by other members. But one more good question.
Yes.
Lyme is something that has allowed me to get a big fat lemon in my lap. So I decided to make lemonade. And in life, I'm sure you've gotten a lemon somewhere. And I hope it wasn't a car. But what's your lemonade?
Well, that's the same situation. I mean, I didn't go looking for Lyme disease.
Right.
You know, it just, you know, like I said, it was chance, circumstance. It turned out that it was so-called a niche that needed to be filled.
I see.
And I happened to fill it, you know, and, I'll tell you one thing. It hasn't been boring.
No, I bet it hasn't been boring because it's all shapes, it's sizes, it's ages, it's genders, nationalities, it's all of that. We're not, no one's really safe.
Well, it's been very, very challenging. And also intellectually and scientifically, actually extremely interesting quite a learning experience. And it also... It, so to speak, tests your mettle as a physician, because this is what being a physician is all about, or should be.
Mm-hmm.
Listening to the patient, examining the patient, using the scientific tools that are available to try to figure out what is going on in what is actually, it really is a very challenging illness.
Well,
And it's a new illness.
You have to use your eyes, and you have to listen. You have to listen with your ears. And the scenario that just at this point makes me crazy is that I got treated with 3 weeks of doxycycline, got sent over to a rheumatologist. I said to him, I'm 75% better. And he just shrugged his shoulders and said, well, I don't know why. And so... That's where the ball got dropped, that if I got treated longer, if he was wiser, if he believed in, you know, the theory of a negative test does not mean a non-infection, then I wouldn't be faced with what's going on with me today. So that being said, it's I welcome change. I really, really do. So I thank you so much for all this great information. And if you had one bit of advice for people who are listening, who may be suffering or know someone who's suffering, what would you advise them to do?
As my patient Vicki Logan once said, if you think you have Lyme disease, you have to pursue the diagnosis. And also, don't give up hope. Don't give up.
Yeah, I think a lot of people do give up hope because it's a very overwhelming and taxing for a variety of, you know, the individuals, their families, whatever. You know, one other question I wondered, did you ever suffer from Lyme disease yourself?
No, I didn't.
Good. Just keep it that way. Stay in the library.
Right. Well, I don't step on the grass where I live unless I am in knee-high boots that are pre-sprayed with permethrin.
Wonderful. Wonderful. I thank you again, and I look forward to seeing you again because we do run into each other from time to time. And I hope all my listeners have really enjoyed this episode. It's very, very eye-opening and actually heartwarming and giving us a lot of hope. So for all of my listeners, I thank you for listening to this episode. You've been listening to Living with Lyme and your host, Cindy Kennedy. And this has been Dr. Ken Liegner. And come back, listen to another episode and do subscribe to the website to get more podcast information. And that's at www.livingwithlyme.us. I'm going to sign off here and take good care.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Living with Lyme. We'd like to take another moment to thank our sponsors. Botanical medicines are an important part of an integrative Lyme disease program. Biocidin from Biobotanical Research is a professional strength, broad spectrum formula that has been extensively researched for effectiveness as nutritional support in Lyme and co-infections. University studies have shown that this combination of plant medicines is also effective on biofilms that may be hampering treatment as well as providing broadly acting herbal support. The liposomal form of biocidin, called biocidin LSF, is used by Lyme-literate physicians such as Dr. Richard Horowitz and Dr. Jill Carnahan. Ask your practitioner about biocidin LSF and visit biocidin.com for more information. Allotest. Did you know that what you eat affects the way you feel? One simple test can tell you which foods to eat and which ones to avoid. Many people underestimate the power of simple changes. Allotest Medical Laboratory has provided food allergy and sensitivity testing services for over 38 years. Allotest Medical Laboratory offers allergy testing for inhalants, molds, chemicals, and foods, as well as tests for food sensitivities, candida overgrowth, celiac disease, and autoimmune disorders. Talk to your doctor today. Take the first step, Allotest. Visit www.foodallergy.com. Master's Supplements. Does living with Lyme ever get overwhelming and finding the right support seem difficult? Well, Master's Supplements can help. Master's Supplements specializes in probiotics, enzymes, and fiber that help support digestive and immune health during and after antibiotics. Master's Supplements products provide results that you can feel working with a 60-day money-back guarantee. Their staff is available to help you decide which products and programs are right for you. Master's Supplements is dedicated to science-based products with the highest standards of quality control. Visit master-supplements.com for more information or call and talk to a team member at 800-926-2961. That's master-supplements.com or 800-926-2961. Thanks so much again for listening to Living with Lyme. We'd like to remind you that if you have not done so already, please subscribe to the podcast. You can visit our website at livingwithlyme.us so you make sure you don't miss any episodes. Until next time, thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back soon with a new episode.